Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the April-May 2025 issue of Guideposts with articles like Spiritual Readiness. Someone cares. Pass it on. Right where I am. I've always had a heart for helping people who looked for ways to do it. But these days, at 82 years old, I don't get out as much as I used to. It feels as if the only places I go to anymore are the doctor's office and the hospital. For a while, it bothered me to think that my days of helping others were over, but then I discovered that I still have plenty of opportunities to bless others. During a recent hospital stay, the nurse who was caring for me confided that she'd recently lost her mother in a tragic way. I told her about a similar experience in my own life, then shared the Bible verse that had brought me comfort. She was so thankful to have someone to talk to, and I felt blessed to help her. At another medical appointment, I chatted with a woman who was scheduled to undergo eye surgery the following day. She told me she was really nervous about it. God prompted me to pray with her. A listening ear, a kind word, a brief prayer, or even just a smile. God has shown me that He can use me right where I am, even in the hospital waiting room. Bernadette Pincos, Biddeford, Maine. So, S-E-W, useful. I'm a seamstress, and I run an alterations business out of my home. I enjoy helping brides look their best in their wedding dresses. Same with teens and their prom attire. Recently, I've taken on a new project, teaching my two young neighbors how to sew. The girls, ages 10 and 12, live a few doors down, and their mom asked if I'd teach them the basics. One afternoon each week, the sisters come to my house and I work with them on their sewing skills. They've learned the different tools used in sewing, the type of stitches, and how to follow a pattern. The girls take pride in completing different projects, and watching them learn such practical skills has been very rewarding for me. I love that my young neighbors can now hem a pair of pants, replace a missing button, and mend a ripped seam. It's gratifying to know that in our disposable society, I'm teaching the next generation the skills they need to fix what they already own, rather than tossing it and buying something new. I've heard about sewers in the UK who set up chairs on the street and show passerby how to mend clothes. Their motto is, "Stitch it, don't ditch it." And I couldn't agree more. It's good for our wallets and good for our earth. Lorraine Howald, Brazil, Indiana. The cutest restaurant in town. I arrived at my son Mike's house and was immediately ushered into the living room. "It's Mother's Day," he said. "Just relax and stay out of the kitchen." I sat with the other moms and grandmas in our family, enjoying cheese and crackers. Then my grandchildren, 6-year-old Rowan and 3-year-old Eden, and their cousins walked in, each with a tea towel draped over their arm, like a waiter in a fancy restaurant. The girls were wearing blouses and high heels they'd clearly borrowed from their mom's closet. The children escorted us to a table outside and filled our water glasses. They presented us with menus Mike had printed. They brought out our salads and proceeded to serve us a delicious home-cooked meal, complete with dessert. It was so cute watching the girls wobble around in their two big shoes. They took their job so seriously. We moms and grandmas enjoyed every bite of food as well as one another's company. Later, the children joined us at the table and entertained us with jokes and songs. At the end, they autographed our menus for us, a perfect souvenir of the best Mother's Day celebration I've ever had. Melissa Henderson, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. Have your own story of kindness and caring to tell? Tell us at email sc@guideposts.org. Cover story, Spiritual Readiness. Meet a YouTube traditional cooking star who finds out the true meaning of preparedness when a crisis strikes her family. By Mary Bryant Schrader, Austin, Texas. If you told me when I was in my 30s that I would now run a popular YouTube cooking channel called Mary's Nest with my husband helping behind the scenes with filming and editing, I wouldn't have believed it, not for a minute. For one thing, YouTube didn't exist then, and for another, I was convinced I'd be a high-powered lawyer with no time for marriage and children. Yet here I am today, a wife and mom, teaching all the things my mother taught me, the gentle domestic arts, as she called them, to more than a million subscribers. Isn't that just like the Lord to surprise us in the most amazing ways? I was raised in the prepper lifestyle long before the term became popular. Mom had lived through the Great Depression and World War II, and she wanted to make sure that I, her only child, was prepared for every eventuality. Hard times can hit without warning, she'd say. She drilled into me that processed foods were bad economically and nutritionally, and that the best buttressed against uncertainty was a garden and a well-stocked pantry and a no-waste kitchen. That's a big reason my YouTube channel is all about how to become a modern pioneer through traditional cooking skills, such as culturing dairy, baking with ancient grains, canning and preserving. What I didn't realize is that on this incredible journey, the Lord was also teaching me about spiritual preparedness, lessons that would serve me well when my little family of three, my husband Ted, our son Ben, and I faced a crisis a few years ago. Let me show you what I mean. Lesson 1. Lay the foundation. Before I met Ted, my life was on a very different track, a fast one. I grew up in the 1960s and 70s in suburban Bedford, New York. Much as I loved the homemaking skills my mom taught me, I couldn't wait to go to college and join the workforce like my dad, a corporate tax executive, my own office, my own copy of the Wall Street Journal with my name on the address label. By my late 20s, I was working in finance in Washington, D.C. and going to law school at night. I was determined to do everything that both my parents had done. When I wasn't at work or school, I was tending my kitchen garden, making bone broth, and sewing my own curtains. I pushed myself every second. Finally, I finished law school and was preparing for the bar exam. One rainy December night, just before Christmas, I worked really late at the office. On my way home, a teenager ran a stop sign and plowed into my car. I thought I was so in control of my life, but as the car spun across the wet road and into a tree, all I could do was call out to God. It had been an awfully long time since I'd talked to him. Though I'd been raised Catholic by devout parents, I put faith on the back burner in pursuit of my career. Fortunately, the other driver and I were unhurt. Sitting on the curb in the rain as I waited for the police, I thought, is this how I want to live? All I do is work and study. I don't have a social life, a prayer life. Something has to change. I was due to spend Christmas in Texas, where my parents had moved for my dad's job. Soon as the police finished the accident report, I hopped on a red-eyed flight. Mom and Dad picked me up at the airport. Is everything all right? Dad asked. I told him about the accident. I've had an epiphany, I said. I want to live a slower, more intentional life. I got off the fast track and moved to Austin, Texas to be closer to my parents. I started my own law practice helping small business owners. I set my own hours and made time for family, friends, and faith. Going to church every week and praying daily made me feel as if I was becoming a better version of myself, the person the Lord wanted me to be. I started to understand why my mom kept Psalm 118, verse 24, "This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it," on our kitchen chalkboard. Doing the day-to-day work, prayer, devotions, Bible reading, gives you a solid spiritual grounding and prepares you for life's inevitable challenges, such as when our son was diagnosed with a brain tumor during college in 2021. I'm convinced that seeking the Lord's direction in prayer, which was already a years-long habit of mine by then, enabled me to stay calm and be strong for Ben when he needed me the most. Lesson 2. Don't put your plan ahead of God's plan. That rainy night car accident made me rethink a lot of things. Why was I working 24/7 if I didn't feel fulfilled? Had I put my plan ahead of God's plan? I was a total type A then, and I had a hard time letting go. But when you release the illusion of control and put your life in God's hands, you'll discover His plans are much better than any you might have. Take what happened to me when I was close to 40 and had all but given up on having a family. I'd calculated how much time I had to meet the right person, build a relationship, get married, and start a family before I would be too old to bear children. The math wasn't mathing, as I've heard Ben and his friends say. No way could there be enough time. Okay, if God called me to be single, I would accept it. That's when I met Ted Schrader. My parents and I and Ted and his mother were flying on the same airplane and really hit it off. Ted was a software developer. We exchanged business cards. I thought he was handsome and so nice, but I didn't expect anything to come of it because he was in his 20s, 10 years younger than me. A couple weeks later, I arrived at my little country church early for Saturday night mass. The lights weren't on yet. I sat in a pew in the dark and prayed, "Father, why do I keep thinking about that guy from the airport? I don't know what your plan is here, but I'll go with it. Guide me, and I will follow." Ted emailed and invited me to meet at a local bookstore cafe to catch up. Was his interest in me friendly or romantic? "I think I'm a bit older than you," I said as I sipped a cafe au lait and Ted enjoyed an iced tea. "I know," Ted said. "You have wrinkles around your eyes." Then he stopped, realizing how that sounded, and added, "They're the most beautiful wrinkles I've ever seen." We had a good laugh over that. In fact, we had such a wonderful time together that by our third date, we were already discussing marriage. Ted was like no one I'd ever met. Whenever an ambulance or fire truck with sirens on passed us, he would pause to pray, "Father, please keep the emergency responders safe, and Jesus, please put your healing hand on whomever they are going to rescue." Soon we were praying together, growing closer to God and each other. I discovered that the same evening I'd been sitting in the dark church, Ted had been at Mass, where a visiting priest asked people to write down their prayer requests and put them in a basket. Ted wrote, "If it's your will, Lord, bring me someone to marry." Ted proposed on our seventh date. We married a month later, and Ben was born 9 months after that. I still laugh at myself for thinking that God could be limited by my math. Surrendering control to God brings far better blessings than anything we can make happen on our own. It was accepting God's plan over mine that led to Mary's Nest. When Ben came along, I threw myself into motherhood. Then we found out Ben had severe dyslexia and other learning disabilities, and it became clear that I'd never go back to practicing law. Instead, I homeschooled Ben. I formed a group with other homeschooling moms. I was in my 40s, and they were in their 20s. They wanted to know about good nutrition for growing brains and asked me to teach them the traditional cooking methods I'd learned from my mom. I hosted classes in my kitchen. Word spread, and the next thing I knew, I was teaching in homes all around town. Ted and Ben suggested I post videos of my classes on YouTube. Before he left for college, Ben cheered us on as Ted and I learned how to film, edit, produce, and build our audience. If I'd done things according to my own plans, Mary's Nest and the fulfilling life I have now wouldn't exist. Lesson 3. Make time to be still and just be with God. Back when I was working full-time, going to law school, and still making meals from scratch, a friend suggested a shortcut. "Why don't you just buy a rotisserie chicken?" I blurted. "That's against my religion. I mean, it's almost spelt that way." What most people don't understand is that cooking the slow way doesn't necessarily mean it's the most labor-intensive. You do 15 minutes of prep, but the oven does all the work, roasting the chicken after that, and the result will taste better than anything you can buy pre-cooked. Much of the work in traditional food preparation is simply done by time. Dough needs time to rise. Stocks need time to simmer. Vegetables need time to pickle. I think there's a spiritual lesson in that. It goes along with surrendering control to God. Sometimes the hardest thing to do is wait, but it's in the waiting, the taking time to listen, that we hear God most clearly. Ben's brain tumor was found during the early days of COVID, when lockdowns were in full force. He'd been having trouble hearing in his right ear. An MRI showed an acoustic neuroma, a non-cancerous tumor pressing against his brainstem. Because of its locations, doctors wanted to operate right away. Then Ben tested positive for COVID despite being symptom-free. We learned we could either wait 20 days for the virus to clear, or we could go ahead with the surgery under quarantine restrictions, which would entail bulky gear worn over the surgeon's hands. Given the delicate nature of the surgery, we wanted the surgeons to be as unencumbered as possible. Of course, we wanted the tumor gone as quickly as practical, but waiting seemed like the wiser choice. I tried to break the news to my mother gently that her only grandchild had a brain tumor. She was in her 90s, and I wondered if she'd be too frail to handle the shock. I needn't have worried. "How gracious of the Lord to give us the next 20 days to pray," Mom said. "Ben is strong, but praise our God that he gives us even greater strength to lean on." Just as my mother had foreseen, the delay in Bren's surgery turned out to be a blessing. Those 20 days gave us the time to process what was happening and prepare ourselves for what lay ahead. Ben made peace with having major brain surgery. Ted and I meditated on the words of Jesus, who taught us that tomorrow will worry about itself. and that if God takes care of the sparrow, he will surely take care of us. We prayed fervently and turned over all our worries to the Lord. The surgery left Ben with no hearing on his right side. None of the inner ear parts could be saved because of the tumor had wrapped itself around them. I waited by his bedside in the surgical ICU for him to wake from the sedation. When he opened his eyes and saw me, he broke into a sleepy version of his joy-giving smile. "Hi, Mom," he said. It was the sweetest "Hi, Mom" I'd ever heard. I think of it this way. For dough to rise, it needs to rest in a warm place away from drafts. It's similar to how our souls need to bask in the light of the Lord, away from earthly distractions. If we can learn to prepare spiritually for what life brings, to just be still and trust in God's presence, he will work things out for good and in a way far better than we could have planned for ourselves. For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Building Stronger Families. A father and son embarked on a cross-country road trip. It brought them farther than expected and closer than ever. The Two Dudes by Jim Hinch, San Diego, California. "So, Dad, the big day is finally here. How are you feeling?" My son Benjamin, 14, pointed his phone camera at me. It was the start of his latest home movie. Car movie, actually. We were in our Volkswagen pulling onto the highway leading out of New York City. I glanced at the camera, trying not to look as nervous as I felt. "I'm feeling a lot of things," I said. That was an understatement. The car was packed with boxes and suitcases. My bike hung on a rack in the back. It was the start of a 6-day cross-country road trip. After nearly 20 years of living in New York, our family was moving back west where my wife Kate and I had been born and raised. I had taken a job as a news reporter in San Diego, ending almost 2 decades as an editor at Guidepost. We had rented a small apartment in California where I would live while Kate, an Episcopal priest, wrapped things up at her current job and looked for a new church to lead in San Diego. On top of all that, Benjamin was starting 9th grade at a boarding high school, just as his older sister Franny had done 3 years earlier. And Franny, now a senior, was gearing up to apply to college. She would turn 18 in just a few months. For our kids' entire lives, our family had been close-knit and stable. Now, as a friend of ours put it, "You'll be 4 Hinches in 4 separate houses. I was especially worried about Benjamin. When Franny decided she wanted to go to boarding school, Kate and I didn't think twice. Our daughter had always been self-directed and independent. Benjamin, I wasn't so sure. He looked up to his big sister, a major reason he decided to follow in her footsteps. But they were different kids. Franny was organized, take charge, and able to make friends easily. Benjamin was messy, creative, and more of a homebody. I worried he'd struggle academically and wind up feeling lonely. Benjamin and I had a tight bond. We called ourselves the Two Dudes. I loved that we were close. My own dad had had a stroke that had left him severely disabled when I was 9, and I had vowed to be the father I never had. Still, I knew Benjamin needed to step out and find his own way. I just wasn't sure that this was the right way. The Manhattan skyline receded, then vanished, and I was engulfed by a wave of doubt. What if my motives for making this move, a mix of wanting to be closer to my mom, who had dementia and lived in a care home in California, and a longtime desire to return to my calling as a journalist, were more selfish than sensible? I'd stepped away from journalism when we had kids because the news business isn't exactly family-friendly. "The kids don't need you like they used to," Kate said when I agonized over whether to return to news reporting now that the kids were both in high school. "If you're genuinely hearing God's voice, it's okay to follow." But what is a call from God? Or was it just me upending our household to pursue a professional dream? I looked over at Benjamin, now filming the countryside flashing past and picking out the next song we should listen to. I remembered the last trip we'd taken, just the two of us, a Revolutionary War pilgrimage to Boston. He was a kid then. He'd saved up his money to buy toy soldiers in the Bunker Hill gift shop. Now he was on the verge of growing up. What if Kate was wrong and he still needed me close by? I had yearned for an involved dad at his age. "Are you sure we're going to the right way, Dad?" Benjamin said. His voice jarred me out of my thoughts. "That sign said we're heading toward Virginia. Aren't we supposed to be going to Pittsburgh?" Benjamin was right. Distracted by my worries, I automatically followed the route we took to visit friends in Virginia. Our destination was Pittsburgh, followed by Indianapolis, where we'd stay with friends. My worrying shifted into overdrive. First day of this trip and I was already messing up. This did not bode well for the move. "No problem," Benjamin said. "I'll map it." "You don't know the way," I said. "Relax, Dad, I got this." He fiddled with his phone for a moment, then said, "Okay, get off to the next exit." I had no choice but to follow his directions. Soon we were winding along country roads. The roads narrowed, then Amish farms appeared. "Are you sure about this?" I asked. The road was practically down to one lane. "Trust me," Benjamin said. I didn't trust anything right now. As if sensing my nervousness, Benjamin trotted out a few jokes about cows and farms. He was notorious in our family for his nonstop dad jokes. I laughed and felt my spirits lighten, a little. Suddenly, out of nowhere, a sign appeared with an arrow pointing towards a highway. "See?" Benjamin said. "You did it," I said. "Right on, dude." He smiled, and I noticed a confidence in his expression I hadn't seen before. I had always been the parent, the solver of problems. Not this time. After that, Benjamin became our official navigator and joke teller and preparer of lunches from groceries we'd bought along the road, and of course, cinematographer. He would film a day's worth of footage, then edit it on his computer. "What shall we call this movie?" he said. We tried a few titles but couldn't settle on one. "I guess we'll figure it out," he said. We stayed with our friends in Indianapolis, then drove through St. Louis to Topeka and on to Denver, where we planned to stay with other friends near Boulder. The days on the road were long, and we grew restless in the car. We started each morning naming things we wanted to pray for. Me, "God, keep us safe." Benjamin, "God, help me not be bored." Benjamin read to us from Mark Twain's Roughing It, a hilarious book about Twain's own adventure out west by wagon. We ranked our favorite Star Wars movie. He sought my advice on girls for the first time that summer. There had been flirting at his church sleepaway camp. He gave detailed descriptions of his favorite roller coasters, his current obsession. Approaching Denver, I spotted a thunderstorm bearing down on us from the south. It was a true monster of the high plains, seemingly on the verge of forming into a funnel and wreaking major havoc. I hoped Benjamin, engrossed in a book, wouldn't notice a storm. Of course he spotted it, and a flash of fear in his face. Then he held up his phone and started filming. "This will be awesome for the movie," he said. I had to admit it was a spectacular sight. Fringed by a halo from the setting sun, the storm seemed to fill the southern horizon, somehow deepening the sagebrush. I wouldn't have noticed if Benjamin hadn't jogged me out of my apprehension, and indeed the worst he got was a hammering of hail. One last hurdle remained, the next day's climb over the Rocky. Our car was old, approaching 140,000 miles and weighed down by luggage. The morning we left our friend's house near Boulder, we pulled onto Interstate 70. All my worries about this transcontinental move seemed to coalesce into one big worry: making it to the other side of the mountains. I-70 is the highest, steepest interstate in the United States, topping out at 11,112 feet. We had driven it once before on our way to a family backpacking trip. I remembered the car struggling with just the four of us and some camping gear. I voiced my worry during our morning prayer time. "We'll be fine," Benjamin said. "This car made it last time, right?" He got busy filming the stunning scenery. On a particularly steep grade, he switched the music to John Denver's Rocky Mountain High, an old family favorite. Once again, it was as if he sensed I needed a boost. "Car's doing great," he said. He was still filming as we plunged into Eisenhower Tunnel, a 1.7-mile passage bored into the mountainside at the highway's high point. "Awesome," he said. Awesome didn't begin to describe it. The Volkswagen emerged from the tunnel, and I felt a rush of elation. Maybe it was the mountain air, but a burden seemed to lift, and I gazed at a high-altitude landscape of God's beauty and power. "You're doing great," a voice seemed to say. Then another echo of Benjamin's words. "I got this." I had forgotten a basic truth about following God. When God calls you to do something hard, He doesn't give you a crystal ball into the future. He gives you just enough information to take the next right step. For the rest, you have to trust. Descending from the summit, I made a deliberate decision to trust God through this move. I didn't have to decide to trust Benjamin. He'd proven himself more than ready for boarding school on this trip. With God's loving guidance, he was becoming his own solver of problems. We exited the Rockies, traversed the Great Basin, spent a night in Utah, and arrived in San Diego the next day in time for an inaugural California dinner at In-N-Out Burger. I thought of a name for our movie, Benjamin said, through a mouthful of fries. How about The Two Dudes' Epic Road Trip Across America? I love it, I said. Epic in every way. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.